Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu, in for Allison Stewart this week. Imagine a time and place where while walking around the neighborhood, you might see Brian Wilson at a piano, working out what would become Pet Sounds. Or you might walk in another direction and see all of the birds hanging out with a young rock band visiting from England, the Beatles. This was Laurel Canyon in the mid-1960s, at a pivotal point in history for folk and rock music. Songs written in these few years, in this place, continue to influence musicians and non-musicians today. The Laurel Canyon scene is documented in the star-studded film Echo in the Canyon, directed by former music journalist, record producer, and label executive Andrew Slater, and executive produced by Jacob Dylan. Jacob conducts the film's many interviews with music legends like David Crosby, Eric Clapton, Graham Nash, Ringo Starr, Michelle Phillips, and much more. Echo in the Canyon is playing now at Cinema Village, as well as the Showroom Cinema in Asbury Park and the Princeton Garden Theater in New Jersey. I spoke to Andrew and Jacob recently about the film, and I began by asking Andrew what was happening in Laurel Canyon at that moment in the 60s that made it the perfect place for this burgeoning music scene. Have a listen.
Well, I think at that time, you know, it was really the age of innocence for the music business and for California and Laurel Canyon. You know, when we think about it traditionally, you think about the era of the singer-songwriter and Joni Mitchell and the search for the individual. And really, the period that we were most interested in was that first period where the bands came there to be like the Beatles. The birds had the mushroom haircuts and they had the velvet collars, and they were supposed to be the American Beatles. But instead, they invented folk rock sort of by accident. And Roger McGuinn taking that 12-string Rickenbacker and, electrifying folk music really set off a wave of change and created this sort of, I guess the echo of their ideas was going between them and their bands and across the street in Laurel Canyon where they were living, nestled in this idyllic little cove there at the, you know, in Los Angeles. And then ultimately their inspiration goes back to England and where it influences the Beatles.
So describe Laurel Canyon a little bit more, because I'm trying to get a sense of whether it was a place that attracted all of these people whose names we know and recognize, or how much that already existed there to a certain extent.
Well, Michelle Phillips in the film tells you that it was a, you know, it was like a place where the cabal was residing. They had actors and philosophers and musicians. So it was always that way. I think the proximity to the Sunset Strip and the way L.A. is laid out, where there is a sort of, you know, mountainous area right there in the middle of your city, created the environment and at least the context for people to reside in this, you know, with the tree-lined streets and hills that go up. But, you know, anytime you go and you're in a major city and you go into a park, there's a sense of like, freedom. You go to Central Park, you feel that way. The vicissitudes of daily life leave you. And I think in Los Angeles, because you're always on the edge of nature, and you're, you know, there's a coyote in your yard, there's a raccoon taking an orange from a tree, I think that sense of freedom and that sense of warmth was a fertile ground for creativity. And again, they all live very close to each other. So I think, you know, it wasn't like they were sending each other files and then trying to get a reaction, you know, on Instagram. They were going to each other's houses and say, hey, listen to this. And it was an innocent time because the music business wasn't big. It wasn't about money and it wasn't about success just at that point. It was the beginning of all that.
We actually have a clip from the film in which Michelle Phillips from The Mamas and the Papas is talking about living in New York and wanting to move back to this idyllic canyon.
We had the radio on and the birds came on. I mean, it was the birds. We were sure of it. Because we knew them. We knew them personally, and we were friends with them. So we said, God, if the birds can have a hit, anybody can have a hit. So we've got to get back to L.A. But we were staying at the Albert Hotel. That's where all the musicians kind of stayed when they went into town. And since John and I had gotten married, I wanted to go back home. And he said, we can't go back home. We can't. that the music business is here in New York. That's when he woke me up in the middle of the night and he said, I'm writing a song. Listen to this. And he played, all the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I've been for a while.
And of course, that became California Dreaming. Now, Jacob, your father, Bob Dylan, would have been in Greenwich Village around that time, correct? I mean, was there any kind of competition or tension between these two music scenes?
I wouldn't think so. I never heard that there was. I think the California scene that we're talking about and the New York scene were wildly different. I don't think there's much similarity other than they were all trying to write songs that they could sing well into the future.
You put out an album of covers under the same name, Echo in the Canyon. Which came first, the idea for the documentary or the idea for the album, or were they always tied together?
Well, we were sitting watching a film, actually, a film called Model Shop by Jacques Demy. It was late 60s. And we saw L.A. in that film. We'd never seen this. And we saw this, you know, view of the city that we knew in this very, you know, young period. And it sent us on an exploration to find the songs that we loved, the things that brought us to California, brought me to California. And as we delved into the material, we had questions about what these songs were about and the context for how they fit into the framework of the history of California's music and ultimately American pop music. And because we know the people, we said, well, why don't we just try and extend this? Because otherwise it's just research for an album. And I think then we went from there and did a treatment and started to talk to people. And what we found was that people were talking to Jacob in a very different way than they would talk to a journalist. And so we had all this great material to make a more expansive film.
Jacob, what do you see as your role having been in facilitating those interviews to reach a place they may have not otherwise have reached?
Well, one, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not even somebody who typically does interviews. So although I wouldn't consider myself a peer of these people, I am another musician. I've talked with plenty of musicians about music. So what I was able to, I hope, was put them all in a position where they were comfortable to talk about whatever it was they wanted to remember about 50 years ago, which just actually turned out mostly to be positive things. I mean, there probably is another movie someone could make about a different version of Little Canyon, but this is their story. This is the one they wanted to tell. This is what they remember. And, you know, that's what we were hoping. It happened. Just as these interviews would unfold, it became kind of clear to us that they were being maybe more candid than they would be if they felt like they were promoting a record or being interrogated by 60 Minutes or something. They were just seemed to be, you know, enjoying the moment.
But we also didn't really want to just get the backstory of a song. You know, in looking at all sorts of documentaries that, you know, we've, you know, both been fortunate enough to see and be sometimes be a part of, we wanted to try to do something like where you could be filming the song being recorded and in the middle of that song, go to a performance of that song live and then come back to the studio and then be in front of the author of that song. And for us, that was something interesting to do that was different, that it wouldn't be just like a historical document of what happened there before.
It really brought a smile to my face to see Tom Petty very early. I think it might have even been the first scene in the documentary, right? It opens up on a conversation with Jacob and Tom Petty. Was that the last interview that he gave before his death?
I think that we've been told that is the last time he sat down to be filmed for an interview.
Does that make you think about it in any different way?
Not really, other than I feel pleasantly. It's kind of, you know, I wouldn't say it feels like a burden, but I'm glad that I do believe his last interview was not something that he didn't enjoy. I know he had a nice time that day, and I'm glad for that.
One of the bands that kind of gets a chapter treatment in the documentary is the Beatles, who weren't really a Laurel Canyon band in the sense that none of them lived there, correct? I mean, did you plan to focus on them and come back to them just because so many of the musicians all throughout kept coming back to the influence of the Beatles?
Well, I think the film is really more about the Echo than it is about the Canyon. The Canyon is the place where it takes place, but the Echo is really the theme. And when you learn that Roger McGuinn went to see A Hard Day's Night and then he saw the Rickenbacker there, and he got the Rickenbacker 12-string, and he electrifies Pete Seeger's Bells of Rimini. George Harrison hears that, and he writes If I Needed Someone, which winds up on Rubber Soul, and Brian Wilson, listens to Rubber Soul, and he records Pet Sounds. And then the Beatles hear Pet Sounds, and they record Sgt. Pepper. And that really is the bedrock of everything that we have in, you know, popular music going forward. So while we may have started by thinking, let's do the story about how, why people migrated from New York to L.A., what we found was that the story really was, when they migrated to L.A., how these ideas just echoed between them and then back and forth and changed the course of music history.
Here's another clip from the film. You'll hear Graham Nash, Ringo Starr, and Brian Wilson talking about the studios in Laurel Canyon.
In America, it's very, very different. Abbey Road was the only place that, that basically we ever recorded, right? There, it was almost like the BBC. All the engineers had these white overalls on, and, you know, if you wanted to bring the bass up, you had to go to the producer, who then went to the engineer, who then brought the bass up. You were secondary somehow to these people in white coats that were really making the music.
They had all these, like, professor guys, you know, scientists upstairs. We were in the studio. It's like an old 40s movie. Oh, watch that, you want to plug in? Let me see what I can do.
Very different here, very much looser. Much better.
Good Vibrations was recorded in four different studios. Well, each studio was different, you know? Like, you can't, not any one studio is the same. Western was good for the instrumentation, like the bass, the drums, guitars. Sunset Sound, I like their attack piano. I used that on the bridge to Good Vibrations. Gold Star was good for just the echo. The echo of Gold Star was good. And RCA Victor. That's where we did the vocal.
Of course, that's Brian Wilson at the end there speaking. In what ways did that difference they're describing between British studios and American studios impact the sounds that came out of this era and place?
Well, I think maybe not so much from what was happening in England technology-wise. But, you know, in America, what was recorded at Sunset and Western and United and Capitol makes up so much of our popular music culture. And so for us in the film, you know, again, the echo is really represented in those rooms. You know, the human voice and instruments have depth and character when they're surrounded by reverb and echo. And the echo chambers that were used on the Mamas and Papas record, or as Brian Wilson says at Gold Star, which is not there anymore, you know, made up so much of that sound. So for us, having worked there our lives, having made other records there, when we go into those rooms, it, you have such a sense of purpose and duty when you're there, because it has that history. And, you know, we're concerned that maybe in 10 years they won't be there. They're single-story buildings on Sunset Boulevard, and Hollywood is being developed and hotels are being built. So we went in there with the idea of trying to film them in a very sort of, in the romantic way, and that we see them in our minds, at least before we got there. And hopefully, you know, we can still have them there in 10 years.
The film is absolutely star-studded. As I mentioned earlier, part of the joy was just seeing Tom Petty and thinking, oh, how wonderful that he's part of this film. I was fully not expecting to see Brian Wilson. I was really shocked and delighted that you were able to sit down with him and have a conversation with him for this film. What were you thinking about as you were talking to him, and what was it important for you to hear him reflect on from that time period?
Well, he's one of the main architects of that sound. He's influencing everybody else in his writing and his record making. And we've discussed a number of times as well already that, you know, one of the things that's interesting about Brian is that he worked pretty much alone, you know, whereas the Beatles had George Martin and they had each other. You know, Paul McCartney had John Lennon, and John Lennon had Ringo, and he had George Harrison. But Brian, you know, he was young, he was very young. He didn't have those types of people in his group. He had it all in his head, and he had these musicians, the wrecking crew that he was able to direct, but they were wise and much older, I want to say maybe not much older, but more experienced than he was. And he was the director in that studio, and they gave him the command, and he shaped these records that, you know, ultimately you follow it, it ends up as Sgt. Pepper's.
My guests are Andrew Slater and Jacob Dylan. Their documentary is called Echo in the Canyon. Let's play something off of the album of the same name. Here's your cover, Jacob, of Go Where You Wanna Go by the Mamas and the Papas.
Please don't follow. You gotta go where you wanna go. Do what you wanna do.
Jacob, you brought together so many of your contemporaries in this film, musicians who really rose to prominence in the 90s and early 2000s. We see Regina Spektor, Fiona Apple, Cat Power, Beck. How did that lineup form, and how did, from so much material in that decade, in that era, how did you narrow it down to 13 songs?
Well, not really easily. You know, we kind of, once we decided it was going to be duets, then you have to take into account two people voicing this lyric and what that exchange is gonna do for the song. And it changed. I mean, when you take a song, if a man sings it or a woman sings it, that changes the perspective. And then if you have a man and a woman sing it, you've got another concept brewing. So, you know, once we knew it was going to be duets, we had to really think about the songs a little bit more. And as far as the artists that we chose to perform and sing, those are all people that we knew. I mean, there was loads of people, I suppose, could have been there. But these are people that we knew, and it was nice to keep it organic. It wasn't a matter of reaching out to record companies or managers. I was calling most people just myself. So it begins with who's in my phone, really.
And the songs, you know, they really are the defining moments of those bands. Because one of the things that we're exploring is the idea of being in a band and why that doesn't work when there's multiple singers and creative people in it. And it didn't last for the Beatles, and it didn't last for these bands. And just so one of the songs...
To be fair, we didn't have to make a documentary to figure out why bands don't always work. I could have just told you that.
Okay. Right. But for them, you know, the songs Go Where You Want to Go is a defining moment in the relationship between John Phillips and Michelle Phillips, because his idea of their relationship was slightly different than hers. In terms
and she
of the
talks about this in the film, yeah.
And the boundaries of it, the personal boundaries of it. And for the Byrds, you know, we did a version of Going Back, which was a defining moment for them, where David Crosby wanted a song about a menage a trois on the record, and he thought that would get on the radio in 1967. Which we know would not, and they sort of part ways. And then there's the Buffalo Springfield and Expecting to Fly, and that song, which in itself frames the film and is sort of the end of the innocence, a metaphor for us. But that, for Stephen Stills, he says that Neil Young wouldn't let him in the studio, and ultimately that's the moment where you realize that people are going to forge their own path and go on to the singer-songwriter phase, which brings Joni Mitchell and on.
That was music journalist and director Andrew Slater and executive producer Jacob Dylan. Their film is called Echo in the Canyon, and it's playing now in theaters. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back.